class today. Glad to see you all here. I hope you all had a pleasant snow day and break and so on. Any comments, questions, concerns, or other things for me before we begin? Yes?
Can you send a schedule on the are they on the website?
Are what on the website? The schedule is accurate as of its current position. Other questions? Okay, first thing I want to do then today is talk a little bit about the homework that's out right now. So, this homework, you get to draw the famous red-blue maps that they always show at election times in this country, except you're going to draw one with all the randomness of extra shades in between. And we've broken this down into a set of methods to write. Most of them will be pretty straightforward, we hope. You will work with a partner, one partner for this assignment. If you go into the homework page, you can register who you want your partner to be. It must be from your lab section. If you don't have a partner, as of tomorrow during lab, your lab TAs will assign you one so that you can work according to that. If you really, really, really hate people, there may be an odd number of people in your lab section. You may be lucky enough to get to work by yourself, if you actually think of that as lucky. But in general, you should work with one person for this assignment, and you should work with them in the same room, at the same computer, and so on. So what are the methods? The first method, you take a CSV file and a scanner, you read it into an array list of arrays. Okay? So we have a string array for each row, and we have an array list, which is all of the rows. So you're going to have a list of arrays of strings. That way we can read the CSV file into this data structure and just use it thereafter. There is, in addition to the scanner and the delimiter, the thing you split on, there's also a third parameter here, which is the min number of cells per row. So if there are fewer elements on a row than that, you don't put it into the list. Okay, so you only have rows that have at least that many cells. The next one, you'll write, takes in that array list of arrays and a string and returns the first row in that array list of arrays that starts with that string. Okay, so you want to find the first row where the first element of the array is equal to the first cell. So it's a way of searching through the CSV file for a row that starts in a particular way. Then we have this purplify method, which is going to return a color object. Color objects are described on the APIs on the course wiki on Colab. You're welcome to read that if you want. There's not a lot to them. We give you a few numbers, how many red votes there were, how many green votes there were, how many blue votes there were, and how opaque we want to make the color. We're going to make low population states or counties less opaque than high population counties. Okay? And then there's a little description of some math you do to figure out what the things you put into the color object are, which ones say red, green, and blue in a particular range. So it's described there, a little bit of math, pass it into the color constructor and return that color. The next one is sort of analyzing a particular format array list of arrays. So once I've read in my CSV file, I've got my list of rows, and if it has this right format, where the format is the name of a state and county in general, a number of square kilometers, and the number of red, blue, and green votes, then we want to output for that entire file what's the largest number of votes per square kilometer for any one county in there, right? So if I look at this first one, I see there were a total of 60 votes over 10 square kilometers for 6 votes per square kilometer for that county. On this one, I have 35 votes over only 5 square kilometers, which is 7 votes per square kilometer, better than 6. And this one, we have 35 votes over 10 square kilometers for only 3.5 votes per square kilometer. So that one is less. We return, if for this particular input, we would return a 7, corresponding to the county that has the most votes per square kilometer, how many votes per square kilometer it had. Just run through the data, you find the biggest one of those, you return it. The next piece you're going to do, you will be given Here, again, a CSV file already parsed into an array list of arrays. And an int. Okay? Now, the array list here is a different format. Every row either have two or three entries. Okay? If it has three entries, it will be the name of a state and county. So, for example, Falls Church, Virginia, in this particular picture right here. It will be, the next one will be the number of points along the outside of this. So if we were to draw a polygon, draw a line around this, how many points would we need to connect to do that? And then the last one will again be that square kilometers. Okay? If it has only two elements per row, then that is an XY coordinate of one point along the outline. So here in this example, Falls Church, Virginia is defined by these 8 points. Okay? Which are, the X coordinates are longitude, the X, Y coordinates are not quite latitude. But anyway, it sort of points around the boundary of Falls Church, which happens to have a relatively simple shape. Some of them have 200 points around them, okay? But the point here, in this particular method, you're given a list like that, and you're given an int, which is the index of one of these three element rows. It will always be the index of a three-element row. And you're supposed to return a polygon object that of the points that make it up. So if I were given the int for Falls Church, I would return a polygon object with these 8 points. Polygon object could be downloaded right here. Okay? There is a polygon built into Java, but you don't want to use it because it doesn't have doubles. And then there's an example of the only two methods you need to know about the polygon, how to make a new one and how to add a point to it. So you'll make a polygon object, you'll add points for every two-element row, until you hit another three-element row, you'll return the polygon. And then the one that actually draws a fun picture. Okay? So this one, you have two parsed CSV files. One for the votes that have been given, we saw what that one looked like earlier. And one for the regions, we saw what that one looked like earlier. We're also given a file name to save an image to. And then a special brighten parameter that makes the map more opaque. Okay? And so what you need to do here is you create something called a scaling image. Scaling image is a class I wrote that allows you to draw without knowing where the points are going to go in front, be ahead of time. So you make one of these. There's a description of everything it can do right here. It just got 4 methods. It should be straightforward. Okay? You can erase it. You can fill a polygon in it. You can display it. You can save it to a file name. Okay? So you're going to create one of those, and then for every region, you're going to look through for all the regions, which are identified by 3 element rows in the region's data. You're going to get the polygon for that region and fill in that region using a color. The color is going to come from an invocation of Purplify based on the data in votes. Okay? So the methods you've written before will all get used here. You're going to use the method that finds a particular row in the votes array to find out how many votes there are. You're going to use the Purplify method to figure out the color that corresponds to that row. And then you're going to use that to fill in that polygon. Then there's some little description about how the Brighton works. Okay. We give you a bunch of data you can use. The 48 contiguous states in the US of A, from 1960 to 2012, every presidential election, we have them all by county. And so you can create fun little maps like this. This is how votes went in Virginia in the 2012 election, where low population areas are very faint and high population areas are not. Okay? And so you can see where people live. For example, here we have Charlottesville, and there we have Waynesboro and Stanton and Harrisonburg and so on. You can identify all the different pieces of it if you want and what they voted. Okay? And you can do that for states, and I have an example code how that works. You can do it for the whole nation. I have example code how this works. It turns out that in 1968, significant portions of the Deep South voted for a third-party candidate. Surprise! Anyway, so you can create these maps using the methods you've already written. Questions? Yes?
Specifically for maps, how do you download the zip file?
How do you download a zip file?
Yeah.
Right click, and there will be some sort of save link as, download link target, something like that. And then once you download it, you should be able to open it. You just double click on it and it should open. Every operating system I know of has zip built in. Did that? Yes?
There are listed which one of them
should be submitted. You don't need to submit a main method at all. You may don't have to. What I want here in this program is a set of methods. The set of methods are the numbered methods up here, 1 through 6, right? So purple map and region outline and so on. If you also include a main method, that's your business, okay? I give you some example main methods so you can test your code. But it's worth noting this main method tests only if you wrote all of your code, okay? You will probably want to think about, I think I actually wrote it here, you'll want to create, you should think about how to test each method individually, okay? So I am not giving you input outputs for each of the methods. One thing you want to talk about with your partner is, how do I know if read CSV is working? Can I test it? Okay? Come up with a main method that uses read CSV and see if it's doing the right thing. So probably as I was writing my code, I'd start with the first one because it doesn't depend on anything else. I'd write read CSV, then I'd write a main method that calls read CSV and see if it works based on how I think it ought to work. And then I move forward one program at a time. Yes?
Any advice for bringing the data file into Eclipse, but have it next to the SRC and it's not able to run?
All right, so the data file. Yes, let's show you how I would do that. All right, so data file. There's a data file here. I can unzip it. So let's save this. Actually, let's just open it. Okay. So I have a zipped information. Okay, and inside this zipped information is a data folder. So I just need to move this into my Eclipse project next to but not in my source folder. Okay, so... Oh, right, they don't let me do anything useful here. All right, let me see if I can... So I would just, in my Finder, if I'm in Mac, in my Windows Explorer, if I'm on Windows, I would go to wherever I store... wherever I store my project. Okay. So I go into where my project is until I see the source folder, and I would just drag the data folder next to it. And if you do that, then you want this, not this .zip, you want the expanded one out of the zip. So if it still has .zip, you'll need to unzip it, which should be able just to double-clicking or right-clicking in Select Extract or something like that. Yes?
What if it shows up in your folder, like my computer, but it doesn't show up in Eclipse?
So, anytime I change what is in a folder and I want to see it in Eclipse, I go to Eclipse, I right-click on the project, and I say refresh. And on this computer, it takes a long time. Poof, there's the folder. And inside the folder is lots of data. Okay. About the elections of Alabama for a bunch of years, and then where Alabama's counties are, and then the elections for Arizona for a bunch of years, and so on. Sorry. Yes, that's not Arizona. AR is Arkansas, right? And Arizona, AZ is... I don't know what all these numbers, letters stand for, but anyway, they have all of them in there. Yes?
Do both partners submit the code or just one?
Only one partner needs to submit the code. Okay, you can switch off which partner submits. I have not quite finished it, but pretty soon submission of one member of the partner will show up in both of their submissions. I have just a little bit of code left to do. Hopefully I'll get that done later today, or certainly before the weekend, so that one submission is the same for both. Other questions? Okay, so that's up. It's due a week from today. We'll give you some time to work on it in lab this week. We'll also make sure you'll have partners in lab this week. I know it sounds big, but there will be two of you working on it. And so I don't think it should be that bad. And if it turns out that it's a lot harder than I expected, we'll readjust as needed. So that's the homework. Let's also talk about how things have happened because of snow days, right? So, if we look at the schedule, you will see we've had 3 snow days. Isn't that fun? So what are we going to do? We're going to talk about classes for the next 4 class periods, then we'll still have test 2 as originally scheduled. So we'll have 4 classes talking about classes. We'll have a lab about that week, then we'll have a review, and the next test will happen. We'll talk about everything we've talked about since the previous exam, which is basically methods, classes, a little bit about arrays. So that's where we sit. Thereafter, we'll move into some more advanced class topics and a handful of other useful techniques. So there we sit. Okay. Any other questions before we get into talking about classes? Okay. Then let's talk about classes. So far, as we've gone through Java, we've learned there are 8 primitive types, and there are arrays, and everything else is made out of a class. A class describes any other type. And we can write our own classes that describe types. Okay? There are a few parts of this, and we'll spend a few class periods going over the different pieces of a class. But the basic idea, we're going to build any type of thing that isn't one of the primitive types out of the primitive types. Okay? That's the goal. So if I want to build some new type, I can make myself a new class, and I can name my class whatever I want my type to be. What type of thing should I model in the computer?
Bread.
Sorry?
Bread?
Yeah, what type of thing am I modeling? Sorry, I can't see who's talking. I didn't hear what you said either. I just heard you said something. Say it again, whoever it was. No? All right, so what should we model? Give me a noun. Anyone, hand, so I can see where you are. Yes?
Table.
Table. All right, we're going to model tables. What kind of table? Are you thinking like a periodic table, or like a table in a Word document, or like a table you set things on, or like the water table? What kind of table should we model? The water table. Okay, so we're going to model the water table. Okay? So I'm actually going to rename this because table is not a good name for water table. I'm going to name it water table. Okay? So I'm going to model water tables. Now I want to describe in my class what I need to know about all water tables anywhere. What is the interesting information that distinguishes one water table from another water table? How much water? Okay, so let's say I want a double how much water. Okay? What else do we need to know about water tables? Sorry, what is it? A water table is the distance you have to go from the ground down before you hit standing water and can dig a well. Okay? Yes? Double distance from ground. Okay, good. So I now have water tables. I can now create water tables in my programs. We'll add a lot more stuff to make this more interesting, but we can already use it. When I define a water table, I need to describe what I need to know about water tables. I can put as many or as few pieces in my water table or whatever else I'm making as I want. It doesn't matter what I put in there. Okay? But that describes what I know about water tables. So let's go ahead and make a new class that uses this. Okay? I'll call it use water table because I'm very creative with my names that way. And because I've just created a class water table is now a type that my program knows about. So I can make myself a water table. Water table. I don't know what we're going to call these. I'll call it W1 equals new water table. Okay. And then make another water table called W2. I've got 2 different water tables out in the world. Okay. Each of these water tables has 2 things we know about it, because we said there are 2 things to know about water tables: how much water they have and how far they are from the ground. So I can, for example, say W1, how much water do you have, should be 1003. Okay? So when I make a type, make a new class, I can get at the pieces inside of it. Now, we will see later that we very rarely write code like this, and we'll see why on Wednesday, why this is not how we usually write code. But the idea is very simple. Inside W1 is its how much water. Inside W2 is a different how much water. Okay? And then I can print them out or whatever I want to do with them. And I run this and I see that I've got two different how much waters. Each object that is a water table type of object has all of the variables I put in the object. It has its own copy of them. Okay? This is the core, the very element of what we mean when we say you're defining a new type. Describing what it has, what it can be, the state it has, and we define it in terms of other pieces. The other thing we usually add to classes is methods. Things that a water table can do. Now, what can a water table do? How about we decide if a water table is a good water table or not? I don't know. This water table is perhaps not my best example ever. Okay, so I'm going to make myself a public Boolean is good method. This is supposed to return true if this water table is a good water table and false if it's a bad water table. So let's say, how about if how much water is greater than a million, that's 100,000, a million, and the distance from the ground is less than 100, then I'm going to return true, otherwise I'm going to return false. Okay? So I can describe this method that just tells me, is this a good water table or not? I don't have to store the goodness of the water table. I can write a method that tells me the difference between a good water table and a bad water table. Yes?
Do you need an else before the return false?
Do I need an else? Good question. A question about methods. Do I need an else? Yes, I need an else. Nope, I don't need an else. I really don't know. All right, the majority of us don't know, so let's talk about it. What will happen if this statement here is true? It will return true. Return does two things. It gives me back the value of the method, and it stops the method. So that will be all it does. It will stop after it returns true. What if this was false? What will it do? It is false, it won't happen. So we'll skip over the if part and we'll return false. So it acts as if we had an else because return stops the method. Yes?
Could you put an else and it would just work?
Could I put an else? I absolutely may put an else. Yep, perfectly fine to put an else there. Matter of case, doesn't really matter which one you do. Other questions? Incidentally, I can actually do this a lot easier than this. Okay, I could turn this whole line of code. I could replace it with return that. Means the same thing, right? Because this statement is either true or false, and I want to return it true if it's true and false if it's false, so I just return it. Also okay. Lots of ways to write this method. Other questions? Okay, so I can write a method. And the method will work differently for each water table. Use that particular water table's information to run. Okay? So when I were to run this, if I were to run w2.isGood, and W1 is good, and W2 is good. Let's actually make one of them good. Okay. We will see that one of them gets false, and one of them gets true. Because when I run it on a particular object, it's going to use that object's information to run the method. Now, we can actually make that a lot more clear when we write our code. You'll notice that how much water and distance from ground showed up in blue. That's Eclipse's way of telling us that something different is happening here than what happened for a local variable. And officially what's actually going on is when I say this, I'm really saying this dot how much water and this dot distance from ground. This is a special variable. Anytime I have a non-static method, a method that describes part of an object, there is a variable called this that points to, refers to the object that is currently running. Okay? So when I run is good with W1, this becomes W1. And when I run it with W2, this becomes W2. And that allows me to get access to the right object's information. There's more than one water table. Which one I'm talking about? I'm talking about this. If you leave out this, Eclipse will guess what you left out. Usually it will guess this and everything will work fine. Not always guaranteed to do that. There's quite a long explanation about how it decides what to put in front of the dot if you don't put anything in front of the dot. So I'm always going to put something in front of the dot from here on out. I'm always going to write this dot how much water and this dot distance or ground. Okay? So that I know very clearly which object I'm talking about. Okay. That was our brief glance at what we're going to talk about. Let's back up a little bit and talk about the concepts of objects, reinforce some of the ideas, and we'll see how this ties back into the code, add a little bit more code in a moment. So, in the textbook, they draw little boxes called UML class diagrams that describe the three parts of an object. So we can have water table. We have the name. So each box will have three parts. The top part will be the name of the class. The second part will be the things we know about it. Okay, so we have the distance from ground, and we have how much water. Okay, and the third piece, the third group, third block there is going to be the methods that exist. Is good. Okay? And you may think, why do I draw this box if I can just write the code? Turns out that often when we're designing classes, it's useful to have these diagrams called UML class diagrams, if not the name's particularly important to me. Okay, but it's useful to have these diagrams. So the first box is, in general, name of class. Okay, the second box here is going to be the attributes or fields. And we'll define what that means clearly here in a moment. And the third box is going to be the methods. Okay? Three things that we have inside of our UML class diagrams that help us define what we mean by a class. There's no code here. We don't write the implementations of anything. My program is not liking me. All right, there we are. Okay, three boxes. The name of the class, the attributes or fields, and the methods. What do we mean by this? The name should be obvious, it's a name. Coming up with a good name is important. If I had called this table, it would not be clear from my code whether this was a table that sits on a table, or if it was a water table, or if it was a table in a document like this table I'm using here. Okay, so we pick a name that means something. We put that in the first box. The attributes or fields of a class are the pieces of information that distinguish one object of this class from another. Okay? So anything that could be different between two objects is going to be an attribute or a field. And we decide there are two things we care about. Water tables, we could add more, right? We could have where it is located, we could have how clean the water is, we could have other kinds of things there. Okay, but the things that we distinguish one from another show up here. And then the methods are any methods, activities, things that we associate with an object. Okay, so we associate telling if a water table is good with one water table. Let's pick a more clear example. So let's make a rectangle. This is the example the book uses. I want to make a rectangle class. What distinguishes one rectangle from another? Anyone? Yes? Length and width. Okay, so I've got length. I've got width. Anything else? That's it?
Color?
Okay. Hey? Anything else you want to know about two different rectangles that makes them different? That's it? Okay, great. So these are the things I know about rectangles. I know their length, their width, and their color. We could make a different set of things, depending on what we thought was interesting about our rectangles. Okay? But this is one example that defines a rectangle. Then we say, what methods are associated with rectangles? What actions do we associate with a rectangle? Anyone? Yes?
Area.
Okay. When we make methods, we're generally going to try to make them be verb or verb phrases. So attributes we'll usually try to make nouns. Methods we'll usually try to make verbs. It makes it easier to understand what's going on. So instead of just saying the area, I'm going to say get area, which I think requires no parameters. I don't have to tell you anything to get the area of a rectangle. What else might I want to know about my rectangle? Or have my rectangle do? Anything? Yes? All right, we can get perimeter. Perimeter. Is that right? Okay. Yeah. Sorry?
Judge beauty.
Okay, so I might judge the beauty. All right. And there are actually, you know, back 2,000 years ago, the most beautiful rectangle was a very hot topic in the art world. They decide the appropriate ratio for rectangle. You should have 1.6182 versus 1 side lengths and so on. We could talk about that at length if you wanted, but this is not a graphics class, so we won't. Other things we might want to do. Actually, let's pause at this point. Okay? Exactly what you put in these boxes varies a little bit depending on who you ask. Usually I will put more information than just this. I'll also put types. Okay? This is a perfectly fine UML class diagram for this class. But I could also do something like say, the length is going to be a double, and the width is going to be a double. It's more traditional in UML class diagrams to put the type and a colon after the name of the thing than to put it before. But I'm okay with putting it before too. So we could say there's a color object that's going to be the type of the color. I don't care whether you put it after or before. I'm actually going to be consistent within one box. Okay. So I can say the types of things, and I can also say the types here. So the type of the area will also be a double. The type of the perimeter will also be a double. What will be the type of the beauty? What type of thing will judge beauty return? A Boolean. All right, so all rectangles are either beautiful or not. The end. That's a beautiful rectangle. That's not a beautiful rectangle. All right, great. Sometimes as I'm thinking about this, I want to also think about methods that change the rectangle state. Or in other words, so I might also want to, for example, set the length to be a new double. Okay? Change the length of the rectangle. Now, you could say I could just assign it directly with an equal sign, and I can, although we'll see why that's a bad idea more on Wednesday. But we can make things that change things. We can also make things that accept other things. So, how about entirely contains? And this needs to be bigger. Okay? So I can see if one rectangle entirely contains another rectangle. Right? I can decide sort of whatever I want to know about my class. I can just describe what I want it to be able to do in this diagram. Questions about the diagram, about the idea of writing diagrams? Okay. Once I have written a diagram, once I've decided what the fields and the methods of my class should be, then it's time to translate that into code. Okay? So let's translate this rectangle into code. I'm going to just copy what I have here since I have it in copyable form, so we can bring it over here. I need to make a new class. And the title of this class should be the title I put up here. So I called this class Rectangle. Okay? And then I'm just going to, for the moment, I'm going to just paste everything I had here so I have it visible for me here. Okay? So this is what I sort of said I knew about rectangles before. And then it's a fairly straightforward to begin translating this into code. Okay? For the fields, I just need to write them down. So I'm going to say double length and double width and color. And I'll have to import color. Okay, just a straight copying down is usually enough. I should comment, though, that usually we will call these private. We've talked about public before a little bit. Okay, public, if something's public in one class, another class can use it. Usually, we will make the fields of a class private. So nobody other than another rectangle is able to touch them. You cannot assign to them. You cannot read them directly. You can only access them through the methods of the rectangle class. This may seem silly, and sometimes it is silly, but it'll actually save us from a variety of problems later on. For example, it might not make much sense for somebody to change my rectangle to have a negative length. If I have it public, then anybody could just go in and change it. If I have it private, then I can control their access to it. And we'll talk more about like details of how we control that on Wednesday. Okay? So I'll usually make all of the fields private. Okay? Fields. Alright, so I have my fields, I just copy them over, I make them private, I make sure the type comes before the name. And there I have set up the information that is stored by rectangle. The methods are not that much harder. Okay? I make them all public, I give them their appropriate return type, I give them their name. And then I actually have to describe what they do. This is the hard part sometimes. Usually it's not too bad, though. We all know how to compute the area of a rectangle, I hope. If not, you can learn right now. Hooray! There's the area of a rectangle. Okay? So I just write the methods to do what their name says they should do. So get perimeter. Okay, and then for that, I want to do, was it 2 times the length times the width? 2 times length plus the width, I think. Right. Now, again, when I'm doing this, it's a good idea to write this dot in front of everything. You don't have to. Eclipse won't tell you to. But if you see a blue variable inside a method, it's good practice to put this dot in front of it. Initially, this will seem like needless work because Eclipse will do it for you automatically without telling you under the hood. But it'll save you trouble later on if you get in the habit. Anytime you see a blue variable, put this dot in front of it. Okay? So I make all of my variables here. I run them through. So I've got get perimeter. Let's do judge beauty. Oh boy, this is going to be fun. All right. Public boolean judge beauty. Okay. So, quick poll. I have seen a beautiful rectangle. I have never seen a rectangle I thought, that was beautiful. Okay, sounds like the majority of you don't think any rectangles are beautiful, so I'm just going to say return false. Okay. You'll notice this method does not depend on this in any way. Jeez, I could actually make it a static method if I wanted. I'm not going to bother doing that. Okay. Let's go ahead and check a couple more of these so I can make my public void set length double length. And I can say this dot length equals length. Here is one of the reasons why this is very important. I don't have to name my parameter length. I can name anything I wanted. But because I can tell the difference between the local variable in black text and the object's name in blue text, I can do this. This dot length equals length. If I don't like using the same name and some people don't, it's perfectly okay to call this something else so that you don't see that name collision. I don't care which one you do. The official Java standard suggests that you use the same name, but you don't need to. Okay? So I can set the length, and I can see if it entirely contains public boolean entirely contains rectangle that. All right, so under what condition does one rectangle entirely contain another? The length and the width are both larger. Okay, return this is length is greater than that's length. And this is width is greater than that's width. And there I have my methods. This is certainly not the only way to interpret a rectangle, but this is now a fully functioning class. I have these methods, they do what they say they do, I've got these attributes, I can use rectangle just like I would use any type that was built into Java. Because under the hood, this is all they all are. A set of attributes or fields and a set of methods for interacting with them. Questions about this concept? Or about my rectangle class in any detail? Okay. We're missing one important piece in order to make a rectangle work. And that is, we cannot make the rectangles very interesting. Let's see that, actually. Let's make a main method. I'm going to call it useRectangle. And I didn't spell rectangle right, so I'm going to rename that. Tangle. Yes. Okay. So I can make myself a rectangle. Is a new rectangle. And that'll work just fine. I can make myself a rectangle and I can do stuff with it. R dot judge beauty, how about? Okay, so I can make a rectangle, I can see if it's a beautiful rectangle, and false, it's not a beautiful rectangle. There's no such thing. Alright, so we can do this. But one of the things I cannot do is I cannot initially make my rectangle some size. Okay? It might make sense to be able to make rectangles that are not zero size initially. But I haven't told it how to do that. There is a special kind of method called a constructor. Constructors describe how to create a new object. So I have my fields, and I have my methods, okay? But I also typically want to have some constructors. Constructors look like methods in most respects, but they got a few interesting differences. First, a constructor's name is always the same as the name of the type you are working with. Second, they don't have a return type. Where I would normally put void or double or whatever right here, I put nothing for a return type. Same name as the class, no return type position at all. Other than that, I can treat them basically like any other class, other method. So I've got access to this, and the usual purpose of a constructor is to set up my rectangle in a sensible situation. Okay, set it up initially to make sense. I'm going to say if you make a rectangle, you don't tell me how big it is, it's zero size. I didn't have to decide that. This is going to be invoked. This method right here, this constructor, will be invoked when I call rectangle with empty parentheses. Okay, so the new rectangle here We'll invoke the rectangle constructor. If I want to be able to make a rectangle with a different width and height, width and length, I think we called it. Width and length. Then I make another constructor. As long as the type and order of the parameters are unique, I can have as many constructors as I want. I can make one that only takes one double, I can make one that takes two doubles, I can make one that takes another rectangle, I can make one that takes a string. I can have as many as I want. And each one gives me another way to construct rectangles. Okay, so I can make a rectangle this way. I can also now make a rectangle by giving it a width and a height. Or width and length, rather. Okay. So by having multiple of these constructor methods, I can make multiple ways of creating my objects. Most classes have several constructors. Some don't. And some of them, they don't make a lot of sense why there are multiple of them. For instance, a scanner, it has one constructor that takes a file, one constructor that takes system.in, and one constructor that takes a URL object, and so on. Different ways of making a constructor to set up the initial state in different ways. So I can make as many of these as I think are important. If I think particular constructors are interesting during my design, it's possible to put my constructors here. Okay? So I'm able to put my constructors in my UML class diagram if I want. I don't have to. There's no need to do that. But if I think, for example, that it's important to realize there are two ways to make a rectangle, then I'd write down both ways to make a rectangle in my UML class diagram. So that it's clear in my design, when I'm thinking about what should happen, exactly what I want to have involved. Questions? Yes?
You said that the onboarding is limited in terms of constructors, that they have to have different parameters.
Yes, anytime I want to have two methods with the same name, that's fine if they have different parameters. If they have the same parameters, you can't tell which one you're using. Yep. So that's true of constructors, it's true of other methods as well. Other questions? Okay. So, let's get back to water table. We can see here for a water table, we have just a little bit of this. To make a water table proper, we should add a constructor, we should make our fields private, probably add some more methods. But why would we do this? Why do we create new classes? Usually when we're thinking about a problem, we want to break the problem down into what things are involved and what actions act on them. So coming up with sort of the design of how you solve a problem, writing your UML class diagram, and then adding those types to your language by writing new classes, greatly expands the kinds of problems you can solve. So if, for example, I wanted to make, Flappy Birds, I would start by saying, what things have to exist? Well, there has to be a bird, and there have to be pipes, and that's it, because it's a very simple game, right? And I describe what I need to know about pipes and birds, I write my UML class diagrams, I'd add those classes by writing them, okay, so they now exist, and then I could start writing the game logic that actually makes these pipes and birds interact in a way that makes you millions of dollars a day. Okay? So this is the basic idea of how most programs are written. Think of the types, write the classes, then write the methods that work on them. So we'll look at more about this on Wednesday. We'll look at some nuances of how these interact with Java. This is Wednesday. On Friday, we'll talk about nuances of how these interact with Java. We'll move forward from there. I will see you all on Friday.